Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Wednesday. It's May 8th at 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And one of the most brilliant minds that comes to our broadcast is none other than Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's written a superb article that he's sharing with our readers and our listeners today. It's called Rising Inequality, and he questions where is the revolution. And so good morning, Professor. Good to have you. Oh, before I even start, I should simply tell everybody that you're the professor at the Graduate School for Public Affairs and Administration at Metropolitan College of New York. You're the research scholar at the Binziger Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, and you're a faculty member in the Milana School for International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School. My, that's a mouthful, but all well-deserving. So, you know, this particular subject matter really brought to home what I remember from the good old days, if you remember when Americans were kept hostage at the time of when the Iranians took all the Americans, and they were sequestered by the Iranians for I don't know how many months before they were released, and their trauma evidently was described as a Stockholm syndrome. And how do you tie all that in, the Stockholm syndrome, income inequality, unrest, and the world of socialism and the world of capitalism? Are we in a state of flux here in America? What's going on?
Well, you would think if people are feeling oppressed enough that they can make a living, the system is stacked against them, that there's no opportunity for them to upward socioeconomic mobility any longer, that the seeds would be there for a revolution of some sort. And that's what all the econometric models of a democracy suggest, that when you have rising income inequality and nobody's doing anything about it, in fact, you're pursuing policies which actually exacerbate income inequality, then ultimately there will be a revolution. We don't see that happening. Now, it's possible, I suppose, that the American worker has been mesmerized by the American ideology so much that they wouldn't think to rise up in rebellion. They truly believe that there is upward socioeconomic mobility. It's just a matter of their time coming. And part of the American mythology is based on this deep-seated tradition, this idea that, as de Tocqueville observed many years ago, America was born free, which meant it was born free of a feudalistic tradition. There was no caste-like class system in the United States, whereas in Europe, you're born into a class. It was caste-like. And the only way out of that class was either through death or revolution. And here, we're born free of that that baggage. And therefore, we have this mythology of upper socioeconomic mobility. Anybody can become rich. So it's the Horatio Alger myth that anybody can rise from rags to riches. And as long as Americans believe that, there really is no need to, for revolution. Now, this actually is a classic question that's asked of practically every PhD student in political science. But why has there not been a revolution in the United States? I mean, it's asked of everybody. And the classic answer is, well, Lewis Hartz wrote this book in 1954, The Liberal Tradition in America, where he basically echoes de Tocqueville's observation that America was born free. And essentially, that is pretty much the argument that's given. But one wonders to what extent that will hold true in the future.
Yeah, well, what's so encouraging about the article here is that you tie in the frustration and the lack of will at the moment, and yet there is a sense of will in the direction that people who feel constrained in life and don't necessarily – they may believe that that they may luck out somehow or another. But I think people think they're going to luck out more by buying a lottery ticket than some other aspect that will come before their life, such as doing very well in business or in their employment, and they'll rise up to a middle-class position. But that's not seemingly the case. Why is it that, like, there were models. I remember there was a time in Israel when so many people had come to Israel from the Soviet Union, and all they knew was socialism, and they imposed socialist ideas and concepts and economic values and standards in the state of Israel from 1948 till about the 1980s, and then it was cast off because it was choking the creativity of the people. And since then, the nation has done very well utilizing a capitalist system, and there is a mobility in the society there. So there they made it like a revolution, but it wasn't quite a revolution that way. I guess it was a governmental edict where we're throwing that out and we're bringing something else in. Is that what America hopes for as well?
Well, I don't know if that's the best model. Israel, yes,
no,
they shook off the socialist constraints, although they still have the Hisa Druth to contend with. But the reality is you have, as a result of the capitalist system that they've adopted wholesale, you have rising income inequality in Israel. And it's almost reaching the levels of the United States. So, and I know this because I'm actually looking at the data for Israel. So it's not exactly a great story. I mean, on one hand, it's a good story. It's a prosperous economy. It's doing extremely well. But it's only doing well for those at the top of the distribution and those who have certain skills that they can use, and particularly in the high-tech industry.
So how does one balance that out? Is there a failing in the capitalist system, in the socialist system? No one's figured that out yet, or have they?
I mean, you do have more social supports in Israel than you do in the United States. You do have a minimum wage, which seems to be more in line with inflation than you do in the United States. You may have some kind of child care allowances that you don't have in the United States. I mean, you have a health care system which is detached from employment, which you don't have in the United States. You have a lot of things that work to the advantage of workers in Israel. That's not the case in the United States. But you also have in Israel are worker protections that you don't necessarily have in the United States. Here in the United States, you have actually this concept of will employment, and your employer can basically fire you for any reason or make up any reason they want to fire you to justify it, but you really have no protections under the law, even in progressive New York State.
So what's dampening down this revolution that could conceivably be there? Because there's a tremendous amount of exasperation in our society, and there's also a change and an assault on the older Democrats, for example, who believe in an old standard, and now we have a young people who are saying, no, this hasn't worked for us. It's time to give it up and move somewhere else. But is socialism the way we should go?
Yeah. The old Democrats, I think, died out a long time ago. They died out before Bill Clinton was elected president. And then with Bill Clinton's presidency, you sort of had this attempt to go to the center. I mean, it had been moving to the left, the party, in the 1960s and 70s and 84. It was clearly to the left when they nominated Walter Mondale to be to run for president from the Democratic Party. And his famous statement from the convention floor, "I will raise your taxes." That signaled to the world he was really to the left. Now, it should have come as no great surprise. He was a protege of Hubert Humphrey. I don't know if he was that far to the left that people they made it out to be. But the point is that Clinton's White House, his party, basically embraced Wall Street in the same way that the Republicans had always embraced Wall Street. They looked to Wall Street for big contributions, and they looked to pursue neoliberal policies of, you know, free trade, globalization, and whatnot. NAFTA is a classic case of this. Let's have free trade, open borders for trade. And if it results in lower wages, then we'll look to put more money into retraining workers so they could be able to adapt to the changing economy. Well, okay, so but nobody wanted to appropriate money for worker retraining. That was part of the problem of the Clinton years. But nevertheless, this idea that it becomes a party on economic policy was not a whole lot different than the Republican Party. So now people have realized that the Democratic Party has not been able to deliver what it was supposed to be delivering, at least going back to the 1930s. Now they're flirting with socialism, and I would suggest that the flirtation with socialism is really, in some ways, a lower level kind of revolution. If, in fact, you can elect a few socialist candidates, and, you know, they will try to introduce socialist policies, they will not succeed because you'll never be able to develop the consensus you need to do that in the halls of Congress, but they will certainly try to do it. And you could say that sort of, you know, inches you towards a particular objective. It sort of smacks of a lower level of revolution. And the reason why you don't have to have a serious revolution is because in the United States, people understand they can always come out to vote. The government does change hands without violence every 2 to 4 years. That works in favor of the public, of a public consensus. It certainly militates against a type of violent overthrow of the government that you would have in a regime which is more fascist or a dictatorship where you can't, where the ballot box is meaningless. But still, the ballot box is limited in terms of what you're able to achieve.
Yeah, that's really amazing. But do people in America instinctively understand that they have that capacity? That can engage in new dialogue, and whether it moves ahead and becomes legislation or not, the government does change, and that it is done without guns and bullets. And is that what sustains us being kept in place, even though financially we may be suffering as a nation overall? Certainly at the lower end, for sure, and even the middle class is getting eviscerated every day. So is the middle class worried?
It should be worried, and I think that we've seen the cracks in the middle class, and I think that's why we have, quite frankly, that's why we have Donald Trump in the White House right now. There was a sense that the Democratic Party was not delivering, was not helping them, was not really attuned to their plight. And you know, not that Donald Trump is a good spokesperson for middle class, he's certainly not, but, you know, he at least heard that they were not, the manufacturing base was disappearing. He understood that these workers were left behind as a result of globalization. He at least went out to these states, Hillary Clinton wrote off as, you know, being deplorable.
Yeah.
I don't have to waste my time there. They're going to vote for a Senate because they're blue states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. She totally ignored her husband's advice to go out to these states. Even in the last week, she came out and said, it's really not the economy, stupid. It's other issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was still floored by all the stuff that's happened. And when I think about the economic struggles by so many people, I wonder how much longer we can keep them in place. Because not that I think they should be kept in place, but there's so many workers in America that are even coming from abroad and are already here, and even Americans who've lost their employment opportunity. Everything is falling apart. So how can we sustain our system the way it is right now? with so many poor, with so many people being dismembered because of robotics and technology. Is this too late for America to change?
It's never too late to change. The question is, what do you want American society to be? If you want it to be a bastion of, you know, unfettered capitalist markets, then, you know, then there are going to be consequences, and you're going to have a lot of people who are suffering as a result, and they're going to be left behind, and you have the seeds of that kind of revolution. Now, whether it actually occurs or not is an open question. If you say, okay, we have to adapt, we have to, you know, we have a great capitalist system. We're moving in the direction of globalization. That's a measure of progress. We're going to move forward thinking, have greater automation, whatever. We need to develop a workforce which is better able to work in the new economy. So they need more training, more skills. We need to beef up the educational system, and also STEM in particular. Then there's a possibility that you can redevelop a middle class, but I don't see any serious discussion of that coming from the mouths of our Democratic candidates seeking the nomination. And I certainly don't see it coming from the halls of a Republican Congress.
Right. Well, that seems like we're not really interested but a society can't just stand and function for the sake of the extremely well-to-do or even the secure middle class, and everybody below them is there just to serve the people who are in a better socioeconomic means. Or is that what you were referring to when you said that there are other aspects of the Stockholm syndrome that play into this whole process, where we have no choice, no options? So in order to maintain our sensibility, our mental sensibility, we just cling to what we have because we have no other choice. It's that or starvation, as you put it.
Well, the worker has no choice but to work. The employer has every choice, but you know, they have reserves of money, so they don't really have to produce. And the employer is able to hold out until they find a docile worker who's willing to do what they want them to do. Really is the measure of capitalism. Capitalism is a system of control. Now, you could say, is it the best form of economic organization? No. It's probably the worst form of economic organization, save for all others. You know, as Churchill's famous observation, democracy is the worst form of government, save for all other alternatives. So it's the same thing. It's the best form of economic organization for organizing the most number of people towards a common objective. The question is, you know, what do you need to do? What is the role of the public sector in ensuring that you have a just capitalist system, one that more equitably distributes the fruits of people's labor? And right now we don't really have that. We basically pay workers for the time that they worked, and then we say we have no obligations to beyond that. The employer is able to keep, you know, 500 times, 600 times what the typical line worker earns in terms of their own earnings. And then they have incredible stock options. As long as the shareholder is happy, it doesn't matter if you're starving the workers.
Well, so what sustains this concept that America is paved in gold, and that causes people to get up and travel by boat and every other which way, or walk miles and miles and miles to cross into America? Do they realize that myth is gone, or are they making so much more than they would have at home that there are no other options? And they send money back home and are barely living on any form of subsistence here. So how do we keep that alive? Is that working as well?
Now, compared to, you know, third world nations where you take the exchange rate into account and people are essentially 30 cents on the dollar an hour, they're doing much better here. It's all relative.
soul relative. Hmm. So, does it look like we are actually going to change the equation, or is it too soon to tell if the Bernie Sanders of the world and other people that have just been elected into office, if they're going to change the dynamics and the culture of American politics? Are there enough people that are going to vote them in, or others in like them?
It's hard to believe that Bernie Sanders can take the nomination, but I suppose it's possible if enough people don't think there's enough hope. I think that somebody like Biden is probably more likely to take the nomination if he can appeal to the blue collar voter out there, the same blue collar voters that once voted for Obama, then voted for Trump because they felt displaced. If he can get them back, then of course he has a good chance of becoming president. However, his time may have passed as well. And you see him pandering to the social justice crowd on the left now. So it's an open question. I think, to be honest, what candidates need to do is they need to put away their public opinion polls, and they need to look at the demographics, labor market demographics, and the changing labor market demographics in each and every state of the union to basically be able to have a message, an economic policy message, which will actually resonate with the voters and lead them to believe that they really do care, and they want to make them part of a solution which will benefit them.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, Professor, then what are you doing in the halls of academia? Maybe you should be there on the campaign trail with not necessarily running for political office, but putting it all together and making it lucid for the candidates that are interested in running.
I'm certainly trying to offer my services to those candidates and campaigns that want to avail themselves of it, but they don't seem to be calling me.
Oh, that's shame. That's a shame for them, and it's also it shows maybe that they don't even deserve to be running for political office.
maybe they don't understand the basics of it. But if you're going
to
default to identity politics and not pay attention to the economy, the concern is, the Republicans are going to say, oh, the economy is doing extremely well. The unemployment rate is down 3.9%, and we have growth in wages. Now, the question is, we have growth in wages, particularly of those skilled workers, not necessarily growth and wages of those at the bottom of the scale. We don't know, you may have created a lot of jobs, but how many workers are working 2-3 jobs in order to make ends meet? So, and the jobs that disappeared, which is one main reason why a lot of people flipped, some places flipped from blue to red, is they're not coming back. They haven't come back. Maybe a few, not many.
And as a nation, are we moving toward trying to create new types of jobs out there to incorporate more of our population? We're certainly not training them for it, or it seems like we're not. You do need people to work. Fast food joint. But, that's not a future because even that's being automated left and right. Who knows? We may never even see another person at the other side of the counter anymore into the future. They may not be human. They'll be just robots. And you order everything by ordering them around. But that can't be sustainable because there are always people that are not getting the educational training. And why aren't we investing then in education if we know that that's going to be important? Or is that also just for the rich and very well-to-do?
Again, there's this American ideology which says that It's the onus is on the individual to pull him or herself up on their own bootstraps. So they have the obligation to invest in their own education so they acquire the necessary skills to command higher wages. It's not the state's responsibility to invest in them. Now, maybe that's a very wrong assumption to make in today's modern economy. There's always been this tradition of public school education going back 200 years.
Yeah.
The question is, what are we teaching them in the schools? And are we teaching them the necessary skills that they will need in today's economy? That's an open question.
Wasn't that supposed to be how they were guided? That was the whole purpose of schooling?
Well, the school system as we know it today was designed for an industrial manufacturing-based economy. So the assumption was that most of the workers, middling students, would graduate from high school, go to work in the factories, have a decent middle-class job, that were unionized, and that those at the top of the classes would ultimately go to college, then become part of the professional classes, the leadership classes, even the political classes. And those who dropped out, they would be your low-wage workers.
Mm-hmm.
Without an industrial manufacturing base anymore, that model of education no longer serves the nation terribly well. Now you need to put more energy and effort and money into developing skills in the technology fields and more math and science education. I don't know, and here's the open question, I don't know that a lot of the students are necessarily capable of that kind of education.
That's a very good question. I think many people would be challenged to have that sort of capacity. So then what does one do when the world is a nation's oyster, and the very well-educated that can direct others might come to America or might be hired in America for a particular reason. But it's not working for society overall. And that becomes a question. Do we need to serve everybody in a society, even including the people in the lower end? Because, you know, society treats people at the lower end as if they were a burden and they don't even want them. So does that change and get even worse? Animosity as well?
Well, again, there's the question of, and it's sort of a moral question. It's an ethical question. What does society owe its members? Why are wealthier members obligated to help assist those at the bottom end of the distribution? Are they? Does somebody
they may not
who
be.
Has
I
been
don't
successful
know if they are.
Owe something to people who are less successful?
Yeah, I don't know if they are. I don't think that was part even of our Constitution or of our national desire. But then years ago, we didn't have a lot of kids out of wedlock. Today we do. And society picks up the tab quite often. Is that where the anger is also? You know, people who are successful and pull themselves up by their own bootstraps are now being burdened by other issues and concerns, or does society really owe people an opportunity because there was also a tremendous amount of bias for many, many years in the country, and not everyone got an education, and some people were marginalized even in school, even though they were tolerated in school, but they weren't wanted in school. So how do we balance all that? It seems like there's so much to balance out.
Well, again, it's a question of what your organizing philosophy is. But if you're going by traditional American, cultural, then there really is no basis for America owing anything to anybody. This is a country built on this idea of rugged individualism.
So maybe we've run that course. Maybe that course is over, and now we're going to find something else is going to rise up and be on the horizon at the moment, but it will happen. And then what do we do with all these people that don't have jobs and no employment. And again, then will society need to give them, you know, an income, a minimum income that they get, you know, as like getting food stamps? I mean, is that the only way to go?
Well, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has basically said, yes, give them an income. There's no reason why they should have to work.
Mm-hmm. And how long will a society want to hold out for that? You know,
it just
doesn't seem like it's moving ahead, or maybe it will be. I don't know.
I don't think the automation is going to be happening as quickly as people think, say it is. I think there will always be jobs for people, needs for people to do certain kinds of tasks that cannot be automated. Even if you automate much of the fast food industry, you still need people to be there to make sure the machines are working correctly and somebody has to load burgers onto the machines.
Right.
I mean, I think this idea that you're going to automate people's jobs into oblivion, I think, is absurd.
Really, because I was very worried. I noticed all of a sudden that the company called Waymo, they're putting cars together. Everything is automated. You call up the service and you order your car. It comes in front of your door and you tell it where to go, and it programs that, I guess, by your telling it, and you arrive there. There's no driver. And they're automating buses as well and trucks. You know, there's so many people who are working these. They may not be menial jobs, but they certainly didn't take a tremendous amount of skill. Didn't require a 4 or 8 year education. You know, but aren't those people going to be displaced? What do we do with all these people that are being displaced now with technology? And that's what corporations are doing. They're going there.
Well, again, I
don't have an answer. I really don't.
I think people miss understanding the intentions of corporate America, and I think they misunderstand the intentions when people talk about the free college tuition and everything else. I think if Wall Street is supporting free college, then you know the objective is to suppress wage to the top.
Yeah.
Just like they support HB1 visas, you know, you want to bring people in to take jobs, high tech jobs away from Americans and at lower wages, and you want to suppress wages there too. Arguably, you could say, look, that's a way of, you know, reducing the dispersion in wages between the top and the bottom, so inequality actually drops.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way you want inequality to drop, because you still have the extreme top distribution pulling away from everybody else.
Yeah. Well, so is only America in this quandary, or is this an issue that is imposed on all sorts of governments, including dictatorships and quasi-democratic or authoritarian regimes, socialist regimes as well? Who's resolving these issues, or has that not yet come about?
I mean, all countries, all types of regimes need a certain level of economic growth to keep the masses happy, and to basically placate them so they will not rise up in rebellion and overthrow the government or the particular regime.
Yeah.
That having been said, other countries are better placed to have policies in place to placate the masses, and we're not as well adept at doing that because of our cultural traditions. You do have, you know, European countries which have more developed welfare states to accommodate workers who are displaced, but again, they're capitalist systems. And in France in particular, you sort of have this playing out of the elites versus the deplorables and these yellow jacket protests. But basically, again, you've got a technocratic class running the government there that basically is immune or oblivious, I should say, to the concerns of workers, the working class in France. And they're basically pursuing policies that are, in some cases, are dictated by the EU, by being a member of the EU. So they pursue these particular policies and levying taxes on people, and they're totally oblivious to this impact on other people. And they just don't get it, or they don't care to get it. But at the same time, they also do have policies in place to assist people who are hurt, which we don't necessarily have in the United States.
Well, you know, it's just like I'm flustered because I really have no idea where any of this can conceivably go. It just seems that we can't. We can't move ahead like this because there's too much consternation, too much anxiety, too much that's going on that causes people to believe that they're not getting their fair share, and yet again, society isn't responsible for everybody. So are we infusing a sense that people need to be more independent and should be taking care of themselves better? And what do we do when they can't or they won't?
Again, it's something that we have to have a discussion as a nation. To a certain extent, election is that type of discussion, but it's not necessarily a sophisticated discussion. You're making a selection for policies based on your preferences, but not that everybody expects that those preferences will be realized. You know, I guess some of these candidates are trying to make an argument for a more caring capitalist system, if they can call it that, but they're not really addressing the economic problems, not really addressing the issues of the middle class. They want to couch the issues not so much in terms of what benefits or hurts the middle class, but what benefits and hurts specific gender groups, racial groups, and whatnot. So they're into this identity politics, and I think, again, if they don't really address the issues of the middle class, they are not going to appeal to the median voter out there that really is in the middle. And that's where that they can lose an election.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, for example, you had those people that did very well in the film industry, and they were able to buy their kids entrance into some very high-end schools. And as long as you get even a passing grade, quite often these high-end schools, their alumni would be able to employ you into the future. How is that? Isn't that like the antithesis of what America was supposed to be? Why do we accept a lot of these atrocities that happen in our name, and it seems to be like, okay, so it happens, so who cares, let's move on. Why don't we have discussion on these sort of things?
Well, I, for one, would never have thought of USC as on the same level as Stanford, but, you know,
no,
I guess if you're part of the acting class, maybe it is. I don't know. You know, I think part of the issue is, you know, you've got people who are part of an elite, and they think the rules don't apply to them. You know, you have one particular actress who's involved in this, who's basically, you know, still can't believe that she's of the mind, maybe she's deluding herself, that she will never, ever go to prison. And the prisons are not, they're for small people, they're for little people, not for well-known actresses. That's sort of the Leona Helmsley story right there. Taxes are for little people.
Right.
That's what actually got us thrown into jail, and which said that in front of a judge. Now, I think, you know, the issue is we've always had a class society, and it's a misnomer to say we've been a classless society. We've always had classes, economic classes, and we've had classes based on, you know, where you go to school and which school you went to and things of that nature. So, you know, we have socioeconomic classes. In some cases, there's the level of education is commensurate with high level of income. In some cases, okay, you graduate from Harvard, you go into public service law, or you become a social worker, whatever. So you're not making a lot of money, but you're still part of that elite elite social class.
Right.
We've always had that, and then we have education for the masses. Well, they're the ones who go to public schools, and they're the ones who go to public colleges, not necessarily even the best state universities, but, you know, public universities which evolve from, you know, normal schools to teaching colleges to, you know, regional colleges, this kind of thing. You know, they're the kinds of place you get a job, maybe as a teacher or maybe mid-level manager in a chain of stores or something like that. But, you know, it's not, you're not going to rise to the top of a particular sector. And we've always had that level of class society. But yet people don't necessarily recognize it for what it is because they've always been led to believe, but I have the chance for upward socioeconomic mobility.
So why does America delude itself to its reality? Or they just, it doesn't matter. It's not part of their world because they don't need to even think about it. So at the lower end, people are getting subsidized, so they're not thinking about it either. Then we also have people at the lower socioeconomic level that are working a second and a third job outside of their subsidies, but that's underground. It's an underground economy, and it's permitted. There seems to be fraud all over the place. I wonder how we can keep on tolerating all of that. There's theft everywhere you look in government and even in business. So I don't know how that can continue.
Well, if there's fraud or if there's a lot of waste, then it just goes to show you that there probably is room for workers to get paid more, and maybe there's room for managers to make a little less money, and they'll still be comfortable. They'll still be making a hell of a lot more money than the typical line worker.
Well, that's brilliant. Right, that's a brilliant thought. But somehow corporate structure is not interested in going there because maybe they want that cushion. They want to have that capacity to pay for pilferage, so to speak. You know, they have that when you go shopping. They assume that maybe 5% or 10% of whatever is there on the shelf is going to be stolen or pilfered, and out the door it goes, and that's it. But that's an acceptable form.
Well, that's part of it. The other part of it is if you subscribe to a capitalist philosophy, then you believe that you're entitled to make as much money as you possibly can make. There's no limit on how much you're entitled to make. There's no such thing as too much profit. There's no such thing as, you know, not profit. There is such a thing as not profitable enough. You can there's no such thing as making too much. You're allowed to make as much as you want. So and if you again, if you believe in a truly capitalist philosophy, there's absolutely nothing wrong with income inequality. We're not all equal.
Yeah, we're not. Well, I guess that's a reality that probably will smack people awake one day or another. But that's probably a hard thing for most people to appreciate. So where do we go from here? Is this the beginning, in a sense, of there's consternation, so there's evidently a need for discussion? Are we going to have enough time before the next presidential election to look into that? We have other people that are going to be standing at city councils and other elected officials. Are they going to be able to infuse anything into the discussion, or is that just something that we talk about as well? We accept it as very shallow discussions that don't really mean very much, and it's just cheap talk. Are there thinkers out there?
They're usually not running for president.
They're not. Okay. Well, that could be problematic. Well, we'll have to see where that goes. My goodness. So what sustains you in knowing that these are the realities, and they evidently are in the front of your consciousness more than probably other people who delude themselves and stay away from these issues and concerns. Is there a sense of melding of the minds of people in public policy?
I think to a certain extent there's a melding of the minds of some people in public policy. I think the policy consensus has generally been, you know, how the economy, the focus, at least the focus on the middle class, has not really been part of that consensus. The focus has really been on helping the poor, and so much of public policy is devoted to finding ways to assist the poor to rise, to move up the distribution. My sense is that not focusing on the middle class is a political non-starter. It doesn't get you support for these kinds of efforts, these policies at all.
Uh-huh.
If a policy has a middle class emphasis, then you have middle class buy-in, and that's what earns you the support for these kinds of programs. So that's there's sort of a disconnect in many policy circles. You know, to a certain extent, if I say we should focus on the middle class, what I'm really saying is a rising tide will lift all boats. So certainly people at the bottom distribution will be assisted when you have policies which assist the middle class. But also, it's a recognition that if you don't have a broad middle class, you're not going to sustain democracy for too long. So democracy is only sustainable if you have a broad middle class. You cannot have these wide gaps between the top and the bottom with nobody in between.
So who's been promoting this changeover, this transformation? There was a time when the middle class was the backbone of America, and it seemed to be okay, but there wasn't really any discussion of those at the top, and there wasn't any discussion of those at the lower socioeconomic ladder. And yet we moved away from the middle class, and for what, 20, 30, 40 years, 50 years, they've been screaming about the middle class being gutted. And nobody was listening. So who's been driving the equation?
The market by its own, being driven by its own force has been driving the equation, been sort of defining the equation. Basically, you can, if you let the market do its own thing, the end result will be, particularly in the global economy, you're going to have the disappearance of the middle class unless you have policies in place to maintain the middle class. We are a country which doesn't really believe in too much intervention in the economy, it's very hard to find just what policies would be beneficial to the middle class. But you see these discussions all the time. Well, I don't want to have a minimum wage. I don't want to have this worker protection. I don't want to have that protection.
Mm-hmm.
These regulations are basically, hurt growth. Growth is not the same thing as economic development. Economic development is about investing in people and communities so that everybody can prosper, not just those at the top who own shares in companies.
Mm-hmm.
That's economic growth. So it's again, the focus on the growth of the economy, while it looks good, it grabs the headlines on the Wall Street Journal, it does not really tell you that the economy is necessarily healthy, at least not healthy for everybody.
Well, then, how is it, for example, that we don't incorporate the whole idea or the concept that people are aging in place in so many countries around the world? The Chinese are getting older. The Japanese are getting older. In America, we're getting older. To the point where the seniors, the senior set, are really some did well and others didn't do well. But the point is that demographically, we don't even have enough children to replace all those that are going to be dying off. And then how do we sustain societies that way? And is there enough money for all these subsidies all over the place? And what if you don't have a good enough education to be able to sustain yourself? So we're always fighting it out against the Japanese and the Chinese and the Indians and so on. And are we going to be able to succeed against a country like India that's young? You know, most people there are in their 30s.
Again, it's a question of how you want to invest your money and how you want to, you know, what vision do you have for society. I don't think we have a vision in this country. Basically, there's no such thing as economic planning in this country because that's, you know, that's a no-no. You let people
right.
do their own things and everything is all grassroots in terms of economic development. Okay, fine, that's great. There was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal a couple days ago by one of the candidates, John Hickenlooper from Colorado, where he comes
mm-hmm.
out and says, up front, I am not a socialist. I believe in the capitalist system, but I also believe
yeah.
that the capitalist system has to work for everybody. So he comes out and says, he supports a minimum wage hike to $15 an hour and thereby
mm-hmm.
thereafter indexed to inflation. And he basically lays it out. Look, you want to have a capitalist system, but it has to be supported or regulated to a certain extent so it works to the benefit of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? You know, and I've been arguing this too. I don't think there's any great value having all these subsidies in place that basically encourage employers to keep wages low. I think what you need
right.
to have is a higher wage society. And the way that you can push the private sector to higher wages is by having a serious wage floor, which will do just that. It's basically wages, the work, what you pay workers is the cost of doing business. If you want
yeah.
to do business, you want to sell your products, then pay people for the work that they do. But pay them something
mm-hmm.
that enables them to make a living and to support themselves and their families. That's what a true capitalist society is all about. Or one that
mm-hmm.
works in a in concert with a democratic society. And I think if we simply say, let's just adopt the Reagan model of a total unfettered regulation, unfettered capitalist markets, then you're going to see increased income inequality, and you're going to see a lot of anger on the streets. Whether it rises to the level of a rebellion or a revolution that
mm-hmm.
all the econometric models predict will happen, that's another question. It hasn't happened so
mm-hmm.
far, so there's no reason to believe it's going to happen anytime soon.
And so, have we created this dogma that exists now on the world stage because has America been subsidizing the rest of the world? While making believe that everything was hunky dory here, because there's so many countries have developed because of our input and our technology that's gone there, and now they're challenging us. So, is there any room for evolution? There won't be anyone that could be regarded as a top dog, so to speak. You know, so Russia at one thought they were at tops, and they're really just a mediocre nation all around, no matter how you cut it. Chinese are rising, but who knows how successful they'll be. The Indians seem to be in a better place because of their demographics. And where does that leave America? Or do we think that everything's going to go well in America and that we're not under assault and under challenge?
Well, we're not under assault. We're not being challenged with the way other countries are being challenged, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Our biggest challenge is that we have an aging industrial infrastructure, and
yeah.
because it was aging, it made no sense to reinvest or rebuild it. It made perfect sense to move it elsewhere or to invest in other countries. You're going to build new factories and build them where they're cheaper. You know,
uh-huh.
the European countries, you basically had a Marshall Plan following World War II, where the United States invested in rebuilding these economies. And the principal reason why they were rebuilt by the United States was not so much because we had a sense of economic justice, but really was we wanted to keep the Soviets out of these countries. We really
yeah.
wanted to prevent these countries from not being democracies. We understood that a strong industrial base is important to the survival of democratic governance. So, you know, that was the principal reason. But then it created a system where we were going to compete against against these countries with our aging infrastructure. They have a new modern infrastructure thanks to us. We're not necessarily investing in the retooling of our workforce. So that's a large part of the problem. Now, it's true. If you lower tax rates, you will have more spending, and that will fuel the economy in terms of growth. It may actually fuel the economy in terms of job creation, if the more people have to spend. But at the same time, if you lower tax rates too much, you don't have enough resources to invest in education and other programs which are essential for the maintenance of at least a well-regulated capitalist system in the long term.
Wow. So there's a lot to think about here. And then are we finding, therefore, that we're being eclipsed now? Like we have countries like China, they have a thing called the New Silk Road, and they're investing in companies in countries all over the world. Is that the sort of challenge we're going to face in the future, where you've got a behemoth like the Chinese government that can spend money and development that actually will challenge us? And where does that leave our citizens and their capacity to earn a living, not just at the lower end, but also at the higher end? Or the very well-to-do, they have the capability of moving around wherever they want.
Those at the upper end always have the capability of moving around wherever they want. It's the people at the lower end who are stuck. You know, we see this in any number of different policy domains, but that's usually the case.
Well, there's a lot to think about, Professor. As usual, you've kept us on the cliffhanger, which is always very exciting. You know, it's not an anxiety-prone situation, but it's one that causes me to think, and I guess other people as well. So thank you very, very much for your time. And what a brilliant read. So I hope people do consider reading it. Rising Inequality, Where is the Revolution? Good question. Great question. I wonder if we'll take it up. So all the best to you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Be well. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He is the professor at the Graduate School for Public Affairs and Administration at Metropolitan College of New York. He's a research scholar at the Binziger Institute for Sustainable Prosperity and a faculty member in the Milano School for International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School. You may find not only this article of interest, but you'll find some of his books of interest. One is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage, naturally written by Oren M. Levin-Waldman, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. And there's a link to it on the website. And the book makes the case for a minimum wage as a way to improve well-being of middle-class workers, reduce income inequality, and enhance democracy. In another book, of course, it's fascinating as well. It's called Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook, published by ABC CLIO. And the Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook by Oren M. Levin-Waldman, speaks to the time of 2014 when the minimum wage in Seattle was $15 an hour, which was at that time double the federal minimum wage. And then another book that's now in paperback, it's called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory by Oren M. Levin-Waldman. And it's a great read. Charles Whalen of Cornell University said, Levin-Waldman has put his finger on what may be the central domestic political issue of our time, and the book deserves the widest possible audience. You might want to consider getting a hold of that. That's published by Focal Press, which is part of Routledge.com. And you can order the book there. Of course, through any of his books are available through online bookstores, as well as through your domestic, brick and mortar bookstore. So it's something very much to think about. And again, the article is Rising Inequality, Where is the Revolution? By Orrin M. Levin Waldman. Let's take a quick break and find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. Let's start off with what's going on the international stage that relates to the United States. Evidently, Venezuela is going to prosecute lawmakers who backed the uprising. It seems that Venezuela will prosecute 7 lawmakers who backed last week's failed uprising led by opposition leader Juan Guaido. The country's Supreme Court ruled yesterday as Washington removed sanctions against Caracas's sacked spy chief for backing the revolt. The court, which announced the ruling in a statement, said it asked Attorney General Tarek William Saab to handle the criminal investigation into opposition deputies for, quote, high treason and conspiracy. Soon after the announcement, the Constituent Assembly, which effectively acts as a regime rubber stamp, stripped the 7 lawmakers of their parliamentary immunity. What comes now? A trial, said Constituent Assembly Speaker Diosdado Cabello, the regime's second most powerful figure after President Nicolas Maduro. Cabello ominously added that 3 unnamed other lawmakers had been identified and would undergo the same process. The list includes Henry Ramos Alup, the former Speaker of the opposition-controlled National Assembly, Guaido, who is recognized as Venezuela's interim president by more than 50 people and was himself stripped of his immunity on April 2nd, denounced the decision. The government's only response is to persecute because they no longer govern, because they no longer have command, he said. Today, he says, this parliament offers the solutions that the regime cannot and will not be able to give, and that is why it is already defeated, Guaido said during a session of the opposition-controlled National Assembly legislature, which journalists were not allowed to attend by order of the military. In Washington, the U.S. Vice President Mike Pence kept up the pressure on President Nicolas Maduro's shaken regime by announcing that sanctions against the sacked intelligence chief General Christopher Figueira were being lifted. Pence, speaking at the State Department, said he hoped that Figueira's defection would inspire other senior Venezuelans to break ranks with Maduro. Washington, quote, will consider sanctions relief for all those who step up for the Constitution and support the rule of law, Pence had said. I hope the actions our nation is taking today will encourage others to follow the example of General Christopher Figueira, Pence had said. Pence hinted that the United States would impose sanctions on the Venezuelan judges if they used the court as a political tool for a regime that usurps democracy, indicts political prisoners, and promotes authoritarianism. Quote, if the Supreme Court in Venezuela does not return to its constitutional mandate to uphold the rule of law, the United States of America will hold all 25 of its magistrates accountable for their actions, Pence had said. In a speech, Pence also announced that a U.S. Navy hospital ship, the USNS Comfort will return to the area in June for a five-month mission aimed at assisting neighboring countries that are caring for some of the millions of Venezuelans who have fled their country's crumbling economy. The other lawmakers named on the Venezuelan Supreme Court prosecution list were Edgar Zambrano, Luis Florido, Morianela Maganeas, and Simon Calzadilla, Americo de Gracia, and Richard Blanco. The Constituent Assembly has said it would suspend immunity of any lawmakers who backed the April 30 uprising, which set off 2 days of violent clashes between security forces and protesters that left five people dead. Dozens more were injured, and more than 233 were arrested in the unrest. Saab, the attorney general, said separately that authorities have already issued 18 arrest warrants against civilians and military plotters, quote-unquote, following the April 30 uprising. The International Contact Group on Venezuela, which met in Costa Rica's capital of San Jose on Tuesday, announced it would send a high-level mission to the crisis-racked country to monitor humanitarian aid distribution and encourage dialogue. So, unbelievable what's going on there, but very, very tragic. Now, this is important as well. U.S. Treasury's Mnuchin refuses to hand over Trump's tax returns. So the U.S. will not hand Donald Trump's tax returns over to Democratic lawmakers, defying a demand from Congress. That's what U.S. Secretary Steven Mnuchin had advised on Monday. I think we covered that yesterday. It's just I'd forgotten. And I wanted to cover something else with you, what's happening as well in Europe. And it seems that Germany is tracking down alleged Syrian war criminals. And let me just quickly go over that with you. And it seems that after 8 years of war in Syria with more than 370,000 people killed, German federal prosecutors are tracking down former senior officials of the Assad regime who are accused of war crimes. And several arrests have been made in Germany and France in recent months. And so in the quest for justice, the testimony of Syrian refugees in Germany is essential, and that's what's happening there as we speak. So we'll see where that leads. One second. And something else that's of great interest, of course, France has marked the end of World War II with a Victory in Europe Day commemorations. So France is set to commemorate the end of World War II today with a main ceremony in the heart of the French capital. French President Emmanuel Macron will first go to pay his respects to France's wartime leader, General Charles de Gaulle, in the capital before heading to the Champs-Élysées with an honor guard to lay a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier at the Arc de Triomphe for Wednesday's memorials marking Victory in Europe Day, the day that Nazi Germany surrendered to the Allies in 1945. So town and villages across the country will have their own ceremonies to honor those who died in the conflict. France is one of the few European countries that holds a national holiday to mark this historic day. Now, there are other issues, of course, that are going on. And one second, I want to go over to the Middle East as well, because it's always a hotbed of something or another. And evidently, the French and the Saudis are involved in this one. France confirms that contested arms shipment to Saudi Arabia. The French government confirmed today that a new shipment of weapons will head for Saudi Arabia despite claims that Riyadh is using the arms in the Yemen war. The Defense Minister Florence Parly told BFM television the weapons would be loaded onto a Saudi cargo ship scheduled to arrive Wednesday in the French port of Le Havre. Now, she refused to identify the types of arms, but reiterated France's stance that they have been used only for defensive purposes by Saudi Arabia since it began its Yemen offensive in 2015. As far as the French government is aware, we have no proof that the victims in Yemen are the result of the use of French weapons, Pauli had said. And pressure has been mounting on the government after the investigative news site Disclosed, that's the name of the website, leaked a classified military note last month detailing the use of French tanks and artillery in the war against Houthi rebels. Disclose, that's the name of the firm again, the online site, alleged the new shipment included 8 truck-mounted Caesar howitzers, though a government source told Agence France-Presse this week that such cannons were not part of the delivery. The revelations prompted arms sales watchdog ASER to file a complaint with the Paris Administrative Court on Monday, calling for an urgent end to French arms shipment to the Gulf. The court has between 72 hours and a month to rule on our complaint, and technically, if the shipment is still in French waters, the court can halt the delivery, said Benoit Marruccioli, head of ASER, in an interview with France 24. According to Marruccioli, the French government's strategy is to continue the sale of weapons while feigning ignorance of whether or not they are being used against civilians. Knowledge of war crimes being committed is crucial, said Marruccioli. The truth is, France has been aware of war crimes in Yemen since they were documented by the United Nations. Pitting a Saudi-led coalition against Iranian-backed Houthi militias, the 4-year conflict in Yemen has shattered the country's economy and created the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, whose investigators say both sides may have committed war crimes. More than 10,000 civilians have been killed during the conflict, and some 10 million people have been driven to the brink of famine. Now, rights groups have accused Paris of being complicit in alleged war crimes against civilians in Yemen, where around 10,000 people have died and millions been forced to the brink of starvation. The Saudi regime is one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world and has inflicted a terrible humanitarian crisis on Yemen, said Andrew Smith of the Campaign Against Arms Trade NGO, or non-governmental organization. So the destruction would not have been possible without the complicity and support of arms-dealing governments, he said. On Tuesday, all left-wing lawmakers exited parliament in protest after Genevieve Dariussecq, the Secretary of State for the Armed Forces, said there was, quote, no proof these weapons are being used against civilian populations, end quote. Between 2013 and 2017, France accounted for 4% of all arms sales to the Saudis, according to the authoritative Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the SIPRI, well behind the United States, whose share was 61%, and the United Kingdom, 23%. While its sales have declined sharply since 2016, it has resisted pressure to stop arms sales to Riyadh altogether, in marked contrast with Germany, which has suspended all weapons sales since last October. France, the world's third biggest arms exporter, counts Saudi Arabia and the United Emirates as major clients and has resisted pressure to stop arms sales to the Gulf countries. It is a marked contrast with Germany, which has suspended its weapons sales to Saudi Arabia since last October. France has strategic interests in this part of the world, Pauli said on Wednesday, adding that the latest shipments were part of a long-term partnership with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The United Nations says that the Yemeni conflict is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with 3.3 million people displaced by the fighting and 24.1 million people in need of aid. So, very compelling and frightening news, to say the least. Now, let me just quickly look to see what else is going on the world stage. Bear with me a moment, and I want to move over to what's happening. One second. And this is important because it points out that Iran is grappling with soaring inflation, negative growth, all due, they claim, under U.S. sanctions. So as Iran scales back curbs to its nuclear program pledged under the 2015 deal, the economic impact of reimposing U.S. sanctions on the country's oil exports is becoming real. The IMF expects the Iranian economy to shrink by 6% this year, with inflation hitting 50%. And plus, Google unveils new privacy features intended to give people more control of how they're tracked online, but critics dismiss the changes as marginal improvements. So these are certainly concerns that are taking place. Now, bear with me a moment. I wanted to check some other things out for you. And I'm going to move into a different realm. And this is with regard to what's happening in Africa. It seems that Sudan's military council want press protesters to back Sharia, the legal system of Sharia law. Sudan's army rulers yesterday stated that Islamic law should remain the guiding principle in the legal system after protest leaders made no mention of Sharia law when handing in their demands for the future of the country. The 10-member military council, which seized control of the country after President Omar al-Bashir was deposed in April, was given the plans for a new political and cultural beginning for the country by civilian activists. The military council told reporters that the generals overall agreed to the proposals, but had many reservations, and these included that the protesters had not included Islamic Sharia law in their proposals. The declaration failed to mention the sources of legislation and the Islamic Sharia law and tradition should be the source of legislation. Lieutenant General Shamsuddin Kabashi, who is the spokesman for the military council, told reporters at a press conference, "Under Bashir, Sharia law was enforced on a haphazard and inconsistent basis, despite it being the Constitution's guiding principle. However, thousands of women were flogged for indecent behavior, according to women's rights activists." Kabashi said the military council was also of the opinion that declarations of emergencies be in the hands of a sovereign authority and not the cabinet as proposed by protest leaders. However, what exactly this sovereign body would be is as yet unclear and has yet to be discussed with the protest leaders. Tension has been mounting as the military council and protest leaders have differed on the composition of an overall ruling council, with present leaders demanding it be a civilian authority and a civilian majority, while the generals insist it should be a military-dominated body. Kabashi said that the military council wants a 2-year transition period as opposed to the 4 years proposed by protest leaders, and protest leaders confirmed they had received the military council's response to their proposals. "It will be considered in this coming hours," said Mohammed Naji Al-Assam, a leader from the Sudanese Professional Association that initially launched the campaign against Bashir's rule in December. But he reiterated that Sudan must have full civilian rule. So that's what's going on over there. And I want to go look at one more thing. Bear with me a second. And 1 second. One moment. I want to just check, see if anything else is going on. And I guess this is really quite important. It seems like we're reaching a point of a showdown. Evidently, a U.S. report warns of serious risks from Hong Kong extraditions. Seems that a report by a U.S. government commission has warned of serious, quote-unquote, security risks from Hong Kong's plan to allow extradition to mainland China, which has sparked protests in the financial hub. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which was set up by Congress to advise on the security implications of U.S. trade with China, said the extradition bill could affect the entitled or the estimated 85,000 U.S. citizens and 1,300 U.S. firms in Hong Kong. The proposed changes in Hong Kong's constitutional law and laws would create serious risk to the for U.S. national security and economic interest in the territory, said the report, which was released yesterday. The new arrangement would diminish Hong Kong's reputation as a safe place for U.S. and international business operations and could pose increased risks for U.S. citizens and port calls in the area, it said. Well, the report said that the bill was part of China's accelerated intrusions into the rule of law in Hong Kong, going against the own party two systems promise made by Beijing before Britain handed over the colony in 1997. Hong Kong maintains a separate legal system and has historically balked at extraditions in the parkland for China's opaque criminal justice system and its liberal use of the death penalty. But earlier this year, Hong Kong's government announced plans to overhaul its extradition rules, allowing the transfer of fugitives with mainland China, Macau, and Taiwan on a ceasefire cause basis. In response to the report, the government of the city, known officially as the Hong Kong Social Security, or rather Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, said it abided by the rules of law and had long-term agreements to surrender fugitives with 20 jurisdictions, including the United States. So the current exercise is about amending local laws to enhance the Hong Kong SARs capable of dealing with fugitives of serious criminal offenses and marking the HKSAR a better partner in the international fight against crime, it said in a statement. So there you have it, folks. That's what we have for you today. Tomorrow is another day, and I'm looking forward to it. We're going to be speaking with John and Lori Wiles, and bear with me a split second because I want to look up the car that we're going to, it's a truck I know that we're going to be reviewing tomorrow. Bear with me a moment. 1 second. All right, I've got to enter this somehow. All right, let's see if we can get it here. Okay, here's Thursday. Yep, we're going to be doing a review of the 2019 Silverado four-wheel drive LT DBL. So that'll be on tomorrow from 10 to 10:30, and I hope you'll be able to join us. All the best, and thank you. I'm going to go back to our studio screen and close shop. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. Oh, goodness, goodness, goodness. So there we are. I guess that's where we stand. I guess it's time for us to say goodbye. So I want to thank you, and hopefully you'll join us tomorrow. And be well. Goodbye.